Welcome to the New Books Network.
I'm Chris Holmes, and this is Burned by Books. Here you'll find interviews with writers you already love, like Jennifer Egan and Rebecca Mackay, mixed in with up-and-coming voices like Alexandra Kleeman and Rahman Alam. You'll find us wherever you listen to podcasts, but check out previous episodes at burnedbybooks.com. And on Instagram and Twitter at Burned by Books. Let's start the show. In Jinu Chong's genre-bending brain twister of a debut novel, Flux, three characters, Bo, Brandon, and Blue, who may indeed be the same person, meet each other in childhood, adulthood, and middle age. Each grapples with the ghosts of the past and a deep core grief that cannot be contained within a single thread of existence. 28-year-old Brandon is sleeping with the boss at his media company when a series of layoffs sweep him up and disrupt what seems like stability and normalcy. When a freak accident introduces him to Lev, a mysterious employee of a startup that promises an endless supply of energy for the grid, Brandon is thrown a lifeline, but one that will cost him everything. Bracketing this story of techno-capitalism gone wild are Brandon's memories of Bo's love of the TV show Raider, a gritty noir detective thriller with a hard-boiled protagonist, Thomas Raider, and his child Asian sidekick, Moto. The actor portraying Raider has been convicted of serious abuses, and in retrospective viewings, the show plays with racist stereotypes. And yet something about the television program acts as a talisman, a protection against a childhood trauma that haunts Bo and Brandon. Contesting the nature of time itself, Jinu Chong's Flux broaches questions about how we mourn, what our present self owes our past and future selves, how time loops back on itself as a re-experience of grief, and all while carrying us through a riveting time-traveling story that left me questioning the very nature of what we call reality. Flux defies easy categorization, but that is its magic trick. It is a story of love, grief, capitalist dystopia, environmental catastrophe, the science and experience of memory, and all of those things all at once, while being very much more. Jinu is a graduate of Columbia's MFA program. Welcome to the show, Jinu.
Thank you, Chris, for having me. This is that, and for the amazing summary of that book. I've never heard it like that before.
Well, thank you so much. This is, I'm just looking at the book right now, and its cover matches the wonders within. I wonder if you had a hand in the design of the cover, which is this amazing sort of metallic techno fluid coursing through the title and wrapping around the book.
I'm really glad to bring that up, because the cover is one of my, it was the easiest part of this whole process of putting this book out there, because I, like most authors, had given, you know, a list of covers that I admired or maybe thought could serve as good inspiration for this kind of cover. I was thinking of two. One is the U.S. cover of 1Q84 by Murakami.
And then, I love that cover so much.
It's just fantastic, and just, it's so futuristic and also a little bit nostalgic. I love it so much. And I thought that the title of this book, Flux, would have be able to do the same thing with the letters, because it's just four letters. Mm-hmm. That I put forth that cover as maybe for consideration. And then also a book by Jesse McCarthy called The Fugitivities, which was out a couple of years ago, and is this stark black, white, and yellow cover that feels just really new and eye-catching. And it looks like the designer, her name is Beste Dogan, and she is a genius. She took all of those and made on her first draft, this exact cover.
Oh, this is the first draft. That's really amazing.
And that's what made it so easy is that I got the email with this cover in it. My editor, Carl, said, I really hope you like it. And I was thinking, oh my gosh, I have no idea. Because sometimes you get options or just a sketch of what it might be. And this was the full thing. And I looked at it and it took my breath away. And I had zero notes on it, which was really, really exciting and also very convenient. And it captures everything I love so much about the book.
Well, I love it, and I think it is stark, and it is original, and it matches what's inside. Mm-hmm. This is a novel about so many different things. We could talk for a very long time about all the many things that you contend with. The unending loop of grief, the relativity of time, noir television, Asian American identity, queer identity, corporate greed, and that's just naming a few of the major subjects. How did all of these things coalesce for you into a single digestible narrative?
It's with great difficulty, I would say. It arrived very piecemeal, which was one of the things that stressed me out about writing this, because I try to outline and plan and put in synopsis form an entire big project before I start writing it, because the writing of it really stresses me out and can be kind of not a fun experience, especially if I feel that there's something I need to add or if there's room for some kind of improvisation. I'm not good at just writing. And so I wanted to have everything down in an outline before I started working on the actual draft. And that started, I think, about 4 years ago now. I finished the book by John Carreyrou, Bad Blood, which was, I think it was the definitive account of the fall of Theranos and Elizabeth Holmes, because Carreyrou was the journalist who exposed her and really began the entire chain of events that lead to, you know, her imprisonment now and all of her sentencing that we are now seeing like in present day. But I started with that. I wanted to do a scam story, something about Silicon Valley, something about the kind of the hype machine that exists around startup culture and the way that a lie can just, something made out of literally nothing can be spun into a $1 billion movement for no reason at all. Absolutely none, except that whoever is selling it seems confident or seems knowledgeable and people buy into that without a second guess. I was fascinated with the effect that Theranos had on its board of directors, like all very intelligent, very accomplished people who all just passed their litmus test. All of the investors at Walgreens and all of the editors at magazines who chose to cover her, it passed all of their tests for with zero qualifications. That was so interesting to me, and I wanted to get into that first of all. I wanted to do as well something involving time travel, because it was the idea of stories intersecting each other and the seed of maybe one character who the reader or might recognize as a bunch of different characters kind of talks to himself through curtains of time felt really interesting and rich to do. From there, I was writing a lot of this outline and working on the draft while in an MFA program at Columbia. And the workshop environment, you know, famously pushes you toward literary work and away from genre. I think that's the attitude that persists in a lot of these very high-level programs. And so in that environment, people saying that, you know, they wanted some more information about the character and what it represents about culture, like the questions, sort of hard-hitting questions about what I was trying to say with it. Though those questions influenced me as well and kind of led to the discussion of television and pop culture that happens throughout the book as well. And then probably the last piece was that I didn't really mean for this to be this to take so much from my own experience as an Asian American person, but I think in a couple instances in the beginning of this, Brandon was fully white, and maybe even Raider was white, and things like that, and those decisions came, you know, along the tail end of me figuring out what this novel would deal with. And so it was a lot of different pieces, very complicated. And I don't think I had a great time putting the book together like that. It was pretty stressful, but I think it came out well in the end.
I'm glad you broached the genre issue. There are going to be some Oscar refrains in this interview because, well, why not? But Guillermo del Toro's admonishment to the Academy this weekend that there is no such thing as genre, just cinema, made me think of the status of genre in literature today. Genre boundaries have seemed to drop away to some extent, and your reference to the kind of the requirements of literary fiction that exist in some MFA programs, I think, you know, might in fact be at odds with what is going on in publishing writ large, at least as a means of commercially and critically distinguishing between so-called literary fiction and fiction that carries tropes and identifiers of genre. What's your relationship to genre as you see it, and how do you see it operating in flux?
The very interesting thing about that is that, which I've learned in the process of publishing this book, is that I feel like genre is much more of a marketing term than I thought it was. The reason why I think the jacket copy is written in a way that kind of casts it as this sci-fi thriller more than a literary work is, I think, you know, for it to hit those lists and for search engines to pick it up in a certain way that it could be, you know, that it would be categorized as such. And it worked. I mean, it's on the Amazon lists of science fiction, which I think I didn't really think about before. It seems to be kind of a conscious decision by the author and their whole team on how to actually categorize it, because the blurs between the lines happen constantly. One of my favorite books in the world is Severance by Ling Ma, and she was
I love that book.
Oh, it's a masterpiece. She was very kind enough to read Flux, and then what she wrote back to us about which her thoughts on the book is right on the cover of the final version of the book, and we're so lucky to have that. But Severance is 100% a science fiction novel, but a lot of people categorize it as just fully literary fiction. And I don't think it matters at all outside the realm of sales and publicity. It's any author's prerogative to kind of push back on certain boxes that readers might put them in. Like, I know Margaret Atwood very famously rejects the notion that she's a science fiction writer. And I guess I don't have a problem with that, because it has nothing to do with the writing of it. It really just has everything to do with where it's going to go on a bookshelf that the people in charge will think will make it the most amount of money.
Yeah, that's well said. Brandon Bow and Blue, three names for the same character drawn out across and looped back over and through time, very often feel as though they could be separate characters, and the reader perhaps pauses and imagines, have I, you know, misunderstood this? They seem to be one and the same, and yet have clear differences about their personality, their understanding of their identity. Brandon has a procedure performed on him by a tech startup that is interested in mining neurochemical energy from the brain. That procedure has the side effect, seemingly, of causing a time loop that forces Brandon to relive the death of his mother, the devastation of his father, his estrangement from his brother, and other forms of grief that he's forced to re-remember over and over again. While this is a science fiction trope in play, you're clearly interested in how grief plays with the relativity of how we experience time. Could you talk us through that, at least as how you understand the relationship between time and grief in the novel?
Certainly, that's an amazing question. And one of the lucky side effects, I think, of deciding to do these three characters and having them be the same person in the end is that I get to look at the way that tragedy kind of transforms itself, and then also transforms the person experiencing it over time. And I wanted to strike a very clear difference between all three of them as to how they have sort of how they are at the present moment when we find them, how they are trying to negotiate their grief. Bo is a child and I think has a pretty natural reaction to the death of his mother, which is to kind of reach out for connection. He's almost begging everybody in his family to acknowledge it or to share in his sadness. And the rejection that he faces from basically everybody else in his family on that front is what kind of steals him to the outside. We see the effects of that over two decades on Brandon later, because he's completely closed off to everything and everybody around him. He finds it impossible to express himself, and it all seems to be, you know, his method of coping with that same trauma is to just forget it ever happened because of how the rest of his family had reacted. And then we get to Blue 20 years later, who I think has regressed a little bit. He now is almost unable to live in the present because he is just entirely consumed by his past and not being able to having not been able to reconcile it for the entire course of his life. And that's a big thing towards the end of the book where Lev kind of points out to him that he is incapable of imagining the future, because he is so stuck in what's happened already, and he won't move from it. It's his conscious decision not to move from it, which is a pretty sad takeaway from all of that. But I thought it was poignant because it seems to echo a lot of the way that especially men deal with trauma early on in their lives, and how it kind of forms a poison inside them as that continues to harm them as they get older.
I was thinking as you were saying this that differentiation between mourning and melancholy might be what you're describing, where melancholy is a state of never leaving the cycle of grief and repression of the grief and experience of the grief, and mourning is for a fixed period of time. And it seems as though you're saying that, you know, especially for men, but not only for men, there is a state of melancholy here.
That's exactly right.
One of the most interesting things about the novel is that it starts with Brandon sleeping with a man, and his boss, as it happens, and he'll have later on in the book a prolonged relationship with Min, who will be the mother of his child. Queer protagonists are few and far between in science fiction narratives. Firstly, I'm interested in whether Brandon's queerness helped you to understand the identity flux that he goes through after the procedure. And secondly, were you worried at all about the conservative nature and gatekeeping that can sometimes happen with fiction that operates in the science fictional realm?
Thank you for bringing that up. I don't get to talk about it often, and I think the root of me making Brandon kind of semi-bisexual, maybe pansexual, if you asked him, he wouldn't be able to tell you, and he doesn't seem to really know. And I love that about him, that part of his identity is amorphous to him, and I think should be. I have concern for the way that our society expects, you know, even young people to align with a certain whatever and to stick with it and to have such sharp lines separating them from others. And the labeling obsession feels concerning. And that extends to sexual orientation, to race, and to especially race in this book. I wanted to portray, you know, Brandon's biracialness in a specific way so that everybody who encounters him can't really tell what he is. I feel very inspired by The Sympathizer by Viet Thanh Nguyen and also Invisible Man by Ellison. Those two books are narrated by these very nameless, faceless protagonists who kind of take on the color or the culture of the environment that they're in, and people can't tell what they are. I think that's incredible to have in a main character or someone's point of view. I think that to address your second question about, you know, the gatekeeping of queerness or the fear that some people have in expressing that in science fiction or talking about it. It's a tough thing even now in real life to talk about. It's something that is constantly under attack. And to those who say that it's newly jeopardized or anything like that because of the last few years, it's wrong. It's always in jeopardy. And the only thing that keeps me from, you know, feeling much fear about it is the example that's been made by so many writers before me. And I think there's some really, really interesting stuff going on in not just the genre of science fiction fantasy, but all over that these queer stories are getting at least some kind of traction that they didn't before. I can think of This Is How You Lose the Time War, which is like the biggest science fiction book that I can recall with, you know, two sort of queer leads.
Who's the author of that?
That was written by Max Gladstone and Amal El Motar. They wrote both, and it's from the point of view of two kind of agents, these time traveling agents that are on opposing sides, both women who, through notes passed through like the cosmos and the time space, fall in love with each other.
I need to read this. It sounds incredible.
It's wonderful, and the book has been optioned for film, and I know that both Gladstone and Al-Motar have talked about how the identity of both characters being women in love with each other is non-negotiable. They cannot change. Whoever adapts this cannot change the gender of those two characters. And I think that's just, it's very inspiring to see, you know, that kind of storytelling is always going to be in jeopardy. I don't really see us as a species getting over that. What has been done so far is very, you know, it's invigorating, and it's the reason why I feel like I can go out and do it. And maybe somebody reading Flux, you know, working on their own novel might feel the same way with theirs in the next few years or however much it happens. It's got to be that, because there's no other way to do it.
Yeah, I hope so. One of the competing narratives in the novel is a television show called Raider that Bo watched as a child and which helped to console him after his mother's death. It's a noir detective drama with a stereotypically hardened gumshoe. Why was that an interesting counter-narrative to Bo, Brandon, and Blue's life? And also, you seem to have an affection for noir while also wishing to pull back the veneer of its style to peer at its real violence at its heart.
That's an amazing question. All of your questions have been wonderful thus far.
Thank you so much.
Noir as a genre is so fascinating to me because it is almost entirely style. And it's a style that is so aesthetically kind of comfortable to me, with the hard shadows and everybody's cool and smoking a cigarette and everybody's kind of so they wear their sort of attraction on their sleeve for other people. And it's cool that it feels like a dumb word to use about any kind of art that you like. But the reason I chose this kind of 80-ish Miami Vice sort of atmosphere for Radar was just because it looked cool. And I know that, for a lot of people who grew up around that time, figures like that were the epitome of, everything that they wanted to be and to idolize within a person. Everything, every aspect of, somebody like Indiana Jones or somebody more recently, like, I don't know, like Knight Rider or someone, all the levels of, skill and courage and savvy, it's pushed up to infinity with those characters. And it's impossible not to idolize them. Everybody has a figure like Radar in their lives, I think, especially when they were kids. And I was trying to, I think, to spin it out in a way that, a lot of people might not experience as they get older. I think, when you become an adult, you sort of let those things go, but Brandon can't. And it's just another signal of his inability to move on from the trauma. What you say about noir and kind of exposing the grittiness of it, I think, is fascinating as well, because a hallmark of the show Radar is that it was almost too much of that. It was too dark, and it was too violent for mass consumption. And that's part of what makes it cool to Brandon as well, is that it's kind of, it was shunned away from the mainstream. I don't think a show like that actually existed back then, which was an interesting thing.
Oh, that's fascinating.
In the 80s, like nobody was getting shot in the head, or like there was no real like blood like a Tarantino film or something like that.
It was A-team violence.
Right. And it was very, kind of commercialized and easy for some 10-year-old kid to watch on Saturday morning. But I think what is different about Radar is that it wasn't that. And even so, Brandon ate it up as a child. That I feel like that was something I tried to do to add a measure of unreality to what was going on there.
Crucial to Beau's love of the show is Modo, who's Radar's sort of rescued sidekick, for lack of a better word. And the depiction of Modo, it very much in Brandon's imagination anyway, if not Beau's, is one that hews to a lot of racist stereotypes of Asian characters on television at the time. But he continues to be incredibly important to Beau as a representation of young Asian life on television. How did you want to play with the tension between Beau wanting cultural representation, wanting in some way to see himself and to see himself at the side of someone powerful who might rescue him, and also being appalled later in life by the racism in that depiction?
I think that's so interesting because, especially for someone who is a minority trying to see themselves in media, the match is almost always imperfect, or has been up until pretty very, very recently. Like I didn't actually see a Korean American person in a big movie probably until like Minari, and that was,
oh my goodness,
maybe 3 years ago, like that kind of thing. And
that is shocking.
And so, yeah, when the resources are so lacking to you, you take what you can get. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think Brandon, even though he understands, or maybe he did as a child understand that the show was kind of playing off of stereotype and was insensitive in some way, but it was all that he had. And so the veneer of fandom kind of descended over his eyes, and that he chose just to ignore it. And I think that's something that gets pointed out to him later on, especially when people watch this, people around him kind of realize how much he loves the show and comment like that show wasn't that great. It was kind of racist, mm-hmm. But that was all he had. And so it's all he could do to try at least in some way see himself in media. So as easily as white kids could, mm-hmm. he aspired to that kind of comfort and that's what he was dealt.
You directly reference Short Round, Indiana Jones's sidekick in the Temple of Doom, which I have to say was a bit of prescience on your part. It would be impossible to make that reference now without commenting on how the actor who played Short Round, Ki Hui Kwan, just won an Oscar for Everything Everywhere All at Once, a truly incredible film. Two questions. Was Short Round an important character to you growing up in the way that you describe of needing an imperfect match despite the racist stereotypes that mar that characterization? And two, were you struck by how much Everything Everywhere All at Once is similarly interested in the time loops of grief and split identity?
Yes, I watched Temple of Doom as a very young kid. And that was probably the first wrong decision, was to watch such a horrific movie when I was 7 years old. But I distinctly remember seeing Short Round on film and thinking like, oh my gosh, like his eyes are the same shape as mine. And he doesn't talk the way I do. Like he's got a very thick accent, but I was ignoring that. I was seeing myself on screen for the first time. And it didn't matter at that point that we weren't actually the same. We at least it was, he was closer to anything I'd seen than, he was closer to me than anything else I'd seen thus far. So of course I was going to in some way attach myself to him. And I watched Everything Everywhere All at Once maybe a year ago. And I had finished the novel, and it was a weird sensation to watch that happening, and to also read the ways in which people were sort of reporting on Ki Hui Kwan's shunning by Hollywood, and subsequent kind of 20 years of near anonymity because he couldn't get work, and the way that he would be 40 years old at a theme park and people would be calling him Short Round. Like that's honestly heartbreaking, mm-hmm. because it only happens to people that look like him. Mm-hmm. And I think that the takeaway from it and seeing, you know, right when I saw that movie and knowing how impactful it was going to be and how much people were going to talk about it, it made me happy for him, because I know that his life was so difficult for so long, but there was a happy ending, which doesn't happen for the actor who plays Moto in this novel. He dies as a teenager, kind of tragically, which happened to a lot of was very much on my mind was the voice actor for the original Peter Pan in 1950 or 60 or something. And he kind of aged out of these youth roles. And then as a teenager was found dead in some like abandoned apartment, and his family couldn't even identify the body. Like I that that story has stuck in my mind for a long time, and was one of the things that I wanted to sort of portray in what happens to the actor who plays Moto is named Maxi Lang, but what happens to him in the course of the novel as well. I was thinking about that a lot as to how badly it could go when I was writing his story.
I had no idea the original Peter Pan was voiced by an Asian American.
Oh no, he was a white kid.
Okay.
But I do think it was 1953, and his name was Bobby Driscoll. He was found just basically homeless, dead when he was 31.
That using up and bleeding dry and spitting out works so well as an analog for how you depict Silicon Valley techno capitalism in the novel. And you've already referenced the influence that the story of Theranos and Elizabeth Holmes had on the book. In this case, Io, who is, you know, in some ways a stand-in for Elizabeth Holmes, but I don't want to give away important aspects of the novel, but in many ways is not. But this company, at least on paper, seeks to quite literally sap energy from human brains to charge batteries. And it reminds me so much of, I don't know, have you watched the show Severance?
Yes.
We're talking a lot about things called Severance. Your opening chapter is Severance, Ling Ma, the show. But it reminds me of how Severance invents a way to have workers bled dry by splitting their identities. And I wonder what was interesting to you about the techno-capitalist impetus to extract all of our energy and labor and to have us distance ourselves, almost put that worker self to one side and try and have a kind of a split life.
Mm-hmm. It is, it's terrifying to me because it is basically already happening. Mm. And, you know, there, the conversion of people into just capital feels like a thing that we are creeping towards. I'm thinking about the Amazon warehouses where you have to, like, if you're one of the package preparers, you have to string yourself up with bungee cords and climb like a two-story shelf to grab something from the top. And then if you fall, then maybe the bungee cord catches you, but then you lose like a point percentage off of your efficacy rating. And then you get a ding and then you might get fired. Like that, it's dystopian in
absolutely
concerning because it's true and it's not a fake thing. It's actually happening. I know that the movie Nomadland was kind of it got a knock against it for almost glossing over the way that someone who works in one of those Amazon facilities, in the same way that Frances McDormand's character does in that movie, it can be a miserable existence because you can't go to the bathroom. You get docked for paying, you get docked your pay if you like sneeze and you miss a second window of something like that. That, if, you know, and I think a lot of shows are playing with that and making it literal in a speculative bend. I love that show Severance because it does that. There is a novel called The Warehouse by Rob Hart, which kind of portrays a facsimile of Amazon that goes further in that you can sign away certain rights to be able to even live in the factory, and you get your own little housing, you get your own dining points, and you just become a citizen of the warehouse. I think that's what we're headed toward. Rob Hart is an incredible writer, and he did that perfectly and revealed, at least to me while I was reading it, the way that big tech has already made those steps. We already know what their goal is. And the pieces that come out about, you know, the continuing efforts to unionize or the very unsafe working environments, especially out of the United States, in like the Apple warehouses in China and things like that. It it gets reported, but people don't care that much.
Yeah, there's a, I mean, we can argue lots about Marx, but he certainly seemed to have that right about about capitalism. lest I leave us on such a depressing note, I would love it if you have some recommendations of things you've been loving to read recently.
I do, actually. I find myself not... specifically not reading while writing, because I like to just tune out a lot of the noise. However, this book is almost out, and so I've been able to get back into at least reading for pleasure, and it's been really, really wonderful. The last book that I read was The Writing Retreat by Julia Bartz. It's now a bestseller. It's about a young woman, kind of a failed author, who gets invited to this very kind of prestigious retreat hosted by her idol author, a mystery writer, who has gathered a bunch of other aspiring writers and said, you have 1 month to write a novel and the winner will get $1 million publishing deal. It's like, it's harrowing.
Oh my gosh.
it ends incredibly well. I love that one. I was very lucky to read an upcoming book. It's coming out March 28th. It's by my friend Gina Chung, and it's called Sea Change. And it's about a young woman whose father has disappeared in kind of a tropical maelstrom while on a research trip. And is the last kind of piece of his memory is a giant Pacific octopus that he rescued, that she has formed this bond with. It's very... you know, it's heartbreaking and deals with a lot of the same sort of a human response and negotiation with grief that I find so poignant and what I find myself returning to in my own work as well.
Gina is coming to the literary festival that I host at the college I work at. And I think Sea Change is so brilliant. I love that octopuses are having a moment in literature.
They are, yes. And for good reason. They're fascinating animals.
and so brilliant. I agree that there's actually some wonderful overlays with your own treatment of grief and Gina's, and it's a beautiful book. Well, those are fantastic recommendations, and I can't recommend enough to my listeners Flux by Gina Chung. And it was really just wonderful to get a chance to talk to you about it and to explore this, so many fascinating interwoven narrative lines and points of interest and contemporary topics that just course through this novel. And I just, I want everyone to run out to their local independent bookstore and get a copy of Flux. So thank you, Janu, for coming on and talking with me.
Thank you, Chris. This was incredible. And thank you for these amazing questions. It's the great pleasure to be able to talk to people who've read this now after having had it in my head just privately for so long, and to hear someone's very thoughtful take on it. It's the greatest privilege. So thank you.
Well, it was absolutely my pleasure. Well, that's all from me for now. Many thanks to Jinu Chong for coming on the show to talk about his extraordinary debut novel, Flux. You can find links to purchase Flux and all of Jinu's recommendations at the website, burnedbybooks.com. There you'll find all of our previous episodes, podcast merch, and ways to get in touch. Stay tuned for my interview next week with Rashid Newsom, author of My Government Means to Kill Me. Until then, this has been Burned by Books.